The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 443 for Sunday, March 31st, 2013. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your questions, we share your tips, we love cool stuff found, just like we did last week. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Indeed. So, you know, John, I woke up this morning and I realized it's a very special day. But I went to Google and they didn't recognize that it was this special day at all. And I was totally irate. Did you know that, John? Of course, the special day I'm referring to is obviously that it's World Backup Day.
I didn't know that.
It is. Yeah. So one of the things we'll talk about today during the show, John, you and I talking about our backup strategies is certainly not an event that we reserve to talk about only annually. We talk about it frequently, but I believe at some point during today's show, we should go through our backup strategies and all of that. So being that it is World Backup Day, it's just good to build awareness because I certainly believe in this. So.
And I got to say, Dave, short of you maybe after you buy a new Mac, wondering what this thing called Time Machine is I don't even think it encourages you to use it when you first get the machine. It's just kind of there because I think I told you I got a new 21.5-inch iMac at work. And while setting the machine up, I don't believe at any point it said, oh, yeah, by the way, you want to set up Time Machine? It's positive it did not prompt me to do that.
No,
it prompted me to do some other things, but it didn't explicitly say, oh, by the way, is this thing called Time Machine? You want to.
Right. Yeah. It will only do that if you plug an external external drive in. Then the first time you do that, it says, hey, you want to use this as a Time Machine destination.
That's correct. Right. But out of the box, if you don't have additional external storage, it will not prompt you. And maybe they should change that. But we'll talk about it a little later.
Yeah. All right. Let's start with a little audio tip and see where we go with this show.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. This is Anthony from the Bronx. This little tip I found. While using 1Password, I wanted to print all my logins and information just to have a look at it, but I didn't want to print an actual document. I wanted to print it as PDF. So, like with anything, when you go to print all, you come up with the normal print dialog in Mac OS X. And I'm using Mountain Lion right now, so I'm not sure if it's effective on Snow Leopard and all. But when you go to the print dialog, and instead of printing it, you put save as PDF. In that next screen, there's a little button that says security options. In that security options, you can actually add a password to lock the PDF from even being opened. Or you could put a separate login for it to even be copied, pasted, printed, or anything else. So I found that is a very useful tip when I want to look at my passwords, but to review them to make sure I don't have duplicates running around. And at the same time, I don't want people just opening the document because that would, pretty much prove the whole system invaluable. But thanks, and you can cut me off here.
And cut you off we shall, Anthony. That's a good tip. It's, security and all that's a good thing, I suppose.
That is awesome. You know, that would have been a better choice than what I did for the longest time, Dave, which is to use stickies, which as far as I know, I mean, I was using it because it was like virtual post-it notes, which, some people actually, based on what I've seen, do put their passwords on post-it notes. Some are on the monitor, some are under the keyboard. All right. That's better. But as far as I know, there is no way to secure stickies. Stickies are...
I'm thinking about like 1Password where I have secure notes in there, which is also really handy.
You do bring up. I'm sorry, we're already on a tangent here, but I think it's important. Okay. So Stickies does not have any security that I'm aware of. But if you go to oddly enough keychain access, Dave. Now you may be saying, John, you're crazy. What does keychain access have to do with Stickies? And what it has to do with stickies is that there is a category in keychain access called secure notes. And it looks kind of like a sticky.
Yeah.
And it's basically a facility. Now, probably at first you're like, why do they put in keychain access? Well, probably because it involves the use of a password that goes somewhere in the keychain.
Right. Right. Right.
So, so if you'd like to have notes that are more secure than the average bear, keychain access is one place you can do it. But I like the locking of the file. That's a good, good strategy there.
All right. So I'm going to jump totally around here, John, because you brought up being more secure than the average bear, and I mentioned one password. So there is this thing, and Google's been doing it for a while. Apple recently introduced it for their stuff, and Facebook's been doing it, called two-factor authentication. And I finally went and enabled it on all of my Google accounts this week. And it's actually pretty cool. I mean, for those of you that know what it is, you'll know what it is. But for those of you that don't, the idea is, one-factor authentication is you entering a password in. Now, the thing is, if John knows my password, of course, John, then you can get in to whatever account you want to get into of mine. So adding a second factor is a good thing. Now, we're not doing retina scans yet, but since most of us have cell phones, that's what Google has chosen to use. And that's what a lot of these places, Facebook and also Apple, are using your cell phone. So you set this all up. And then when I log in from a computer that I haven't logged in from before or haven't authenticated properly, it sends a text message to my cell phone with a 6-digit code that I also have to enter. So I have to know my password, factor one, and then this on the fly, on demand code that's sent to my cell phone, factor two. And then, and only then, does it let me in. And they do a cool thing because they also create, I created a list of 10 anytime use codes, but they're only one time use each. So if for whatever reason the text message doesn't make it through and I still need to get in, if I have this list of 10 or however many I haven't used, I can put in one of those codes instead of what it just texted me and it'll let me in. And then at any time I can generate a new list of 10. So it actually works pretty well. And then, John, also for like applications like, say, iOS Mail that don't support Google's OAuth yet and you can't do the two-factor authentication, you actually go into Google and say, I need to create an application-specific password. And it creates a password that it shows you once and you use that in one place. So I have a separate Google password just for my iPhone, and I can deactivate that password at any point in time. But it certainly makes it more secure. And so that was, you know, that was pretty cool. So I figured I'd mention it. Have you done, and then there's something I want to talk about with Apple's two-factor authentication, but have you done this on Google or Facebook or any of these places that allow it, John?
I think I do have on some of my Google accounts, they have asked, oh, by the way, as a backup, authentication means what's your cell phone number? So I don't actively, when I'm logging in, I don't use, and just to step back a little bit here, what we're talking about here is something known as multi-factor, or I guess two-factor authentication. Yeah. And the three factors are as follows. The one thing Dave mentioned, something you know, which is a password that's stored in your brain.
Right.
Something that you have, and that's where we were talking a physical token, like a cell phone or another that some people may have used, is something called a secure ID, which is a little... dongle that you carry around, and it has a number, and unless you have the dongle with the number on it, you can't get in. And then of course the third thing, which Dave hinted at, is something that you are, which is typically biometrics, whether it be a fingerprint or a retina scan or whatever. So the best authentication should require you to do all three of those, but then it can be kind of a pain in the neck.
Right.
So two factors is certainly better than one factor.
Yes. Oh, way better. Way better. Yeah. Yeah. So
someone would have to steal your cell phone now in order to impersonate you.
They would have to steal my cell phone and know my password.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, I mean, okay. You know, I guess these days that's not all that difficult since we all have our cell phones on us all the time, for the most part. But, I did this with Google and I did it for a couple of days and thought, okay, this is, I can live with this. You know, I had to, as with everything related to security, it has an inverse relationship to convenience. So if I wanted Uber convenience, I would have absolutely no factor authentication. I would simply say, I'm Dave Hamilton, and Google would show me everything that they had. Now, that's not good, because that means any of you could say I'm Dave Hamilton, right? So, we've now gone a little bit down on the convenience ladder and a little bit up on the security ladder, and that's okay. So I figured, well, let me set this up on my Apple account. For the record, my Google and Apple accounts, I started using long before I started using 1Password. So I actually had the same password for both of these accounts. Yeah, I know you're not supposed to do that, but whatever. So I'd never been compromised. So, you know, it didn't hurt all that much. But when I went to enable 2-factor for Apple on Friday, they said you have to have a more secure password to begin with, which sort of made me scratch my head. Like, why do you now care so much about my password if we're also going to be doing this other thing? But OK, fine. So I reluctantly changed my password, which means my iTunes purchases and all that stuff that had sort of become ingrained in me. But I changed it. And it's not so bad. And then they said, OK, now you have to wait 3 days. You just changed your password. You can't enable 2-factor authentication for 3 days now that you've changed it, because just in case your account was compromised, we're going to protect you against that. So I can't enable that till tomorrow, which is Monday. But so we'll see how that goes. We do have a tip, though, John, about 2-factor authentication with Apple IDs. And I'm going to share that at some point here. I can do it now, or if you've got a comment about all of this again, I can wait. That's up to you, John.
Well, if it flows, you might as well.
Well, all right.
It seems very timely. Why it's all happening now?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, listener John writes, in the news, I read that Apple had introduced 2-factor authentication. I came across a slight problem. I have 2 Apple IDs, one for iCloud and another for store purchases. It doesn't look like Find My iPhone plays nicely in a situation with 2 IDs. So I wasted some time revisiting the old, can I merge my Apple IDs, or even how do I use 2-factor authentication with 2 Apple IDs, with the usual lack of success. However, I did find a solution that's not ideal, but kind of achieves what I want. 99% of my purchases have been through my non-me.com ID, so that's the one I must keep. My me.com account has my Apple forums, level 4, whatever, emails, calendars, etc. It occurred to me that whilst I would lose my forum level, I can move data such as emails, calendar, events, etc. to my non-me.com ID. I do pay for iCloud storage, but I guess I can downgrade and sign up for more on the other ID. I've logged into my non-me.com ID and created a new @iCloud email address there. Obviously, there are some compromises with this approach, but it does offer me a way of finally moving to a single Apple ID. It seems that Apple's suggestion of having separate IDs for iCloud and App Store /iTunes is also a bit of a compromise. I've fallen into the trap of accidentally buying content under the wrong ID, setting up new devices with the wrong ID. So I think it's worth it for the short-term pain for the long-term gain. So there you go. That's that. I'm curious to see how this goes with 2-factor auth on one and not having it on the other. And because I have, we have 2 accounts for store purchases, but we'll see how it goes. So thanks, John. It's good stuff. So there we are. You want to jump to Joseph here, John? Are we done with this particular tangent? Does anybody in the chat room have anything to say about this? Let me scan the chat room. I'll say hello to everybody in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream. We've got quite a full group this morning, especially considering that it's early Sunday morning and it's a holiday for many. So thanks for joining us. Anything, John?
From Joseph, here we go.
Go.
Hi. I just had to restore my iPhone due to a slightly botched firmware update, as I had VMware running a Windows machine, and when the phone rebooted, it tried to connect to the PC rather than the Mac that was doing the update. Ooh.
Where are you
VMware
here, John?
Would, Joseph?
Okay.
Are we looking at different emails here?
Oh, no. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, no, you're right. Go.
No, what I was just saying here is that the first part of this is based on the last I used VMware. It typically comes up and says, hey, I see a USB device. Who gets it?
Yeah, okay. Maybe you're in a different spot. Your thing had discussed that. Oh, never mind. No, I see where you're going. Keep going. Go.
I think I pulled up a different version of the email.
Yes, exactly.
Than you packaged in lately. Anyways, when I had it restored from the backup I'd taken, the iPhone downloaded all 1,000 of my emails again, and not wanting to tap each one to mark it as read, I went to Google a solution and found the following.
I can. I'll put the link in the show notes. You can keep reading.
Oh, great. Okay. And so here's a way to do that. So you just want to pass along here, and we'll summarize what the tip tells you. But basically what you do is you start up and you open the Mail app and tap the edit button. And then what you do is follows. And it's certainly not intuitive. And I don't know if it's actually like a little bug, but here's what you do. So you select one message. Once you select a message, you'll then see some buttons appear at the bottom of the screen. Then what you want to do is press and hold the mark button. And then, I think this is the important part, while still pressing and holding the mark button, tap the email that you just selected to unmark it. Then release the mark button and tap the mark as read button. And apparently what you're doing is you're putting it in a state where, yeah, nothing is selected, but apparently it does mark them all as read. So
yeah,
I would have never thought to do this.
No, it's really smart. Yeah.
And I think it was an accident that somebody just stumbled across this finger fumble and turned into a tip.
Yeah, it's a good finger fumble tip. I like that. Yep, absolutely. All right. Jumping around randomly here, I'll go with another tip. This is one of these, you know, we share a lot of stuff that's like this, actually, probably more than we even realize we share, John. But this is one of those things that when I heard it, I thought, man, I don't need to know this now. But the day that I need to know this is absolutely the day that I want to know, because I don't want to have to hunt for the solution like this poor guy did. So with that in mind, yet another John writes, after not being able to log into iMessage on my Retina MacBook Pro on my latest plane flight, I'm getting multiple errors about how I couldn't attach to the server and register. I spent a few hours of good Google foo. It turns out that you can't sign into iMessage from a Mac if there isn't a valid serial number coded to the motherboard. I had the motherboard replaced by Apple about 2 weeks ago for a port problem, and AppleCare covered it. But it turns out that they forgot to code the system serial number into the new motherboard, and that is what was causing my login issue. A 3-minute talk with the genius at the Apple Store, and that got them to code it properly. I have used the blank board serializer software, but it wouldn't boot with the new EFI. Turns out they don't have separate software anymore. Now, when they boot their workbench diagnostics at the Genius Bar, it requires the serial number to be coded or it won't run. So the question I ask is, that wasn't really answered with more than a nervous chuckle, is, does this mean that they replaced the motherboard and failed to run diagnostics before returning it to me? Well, it probably does. But thanks for that tip. That's a good little thing for us to file away and know. So you got to, if that happens, of course, you just got to go back to the Genius Bar. But yeah, when they replace your motherboard, they put it in and then they code it with the serial number, which seems totally backwards. But that's how that process works. So if it doesn't have a serial number, no go. And perhaps that's a anti-theft thing. I don't know, whatever it is. But anyway, I don't know why. I guess they do that for, I don't know why they would do that. But that's what they do, John.
Why they, what, wouldn't program the serial number?
No, why iMessage requires a serial number to run.
I don't know. It could be just some piece of the code that someone left in there.
Right.
Never thought that they'd. Yeah, I mean, this happens a lot. I mean, it could have been left in there and the assumption was, well, you know, every machine has a serial number. So
yeah, what's the problem?
Until you come across, and I've had that happen with my code too, is where, you know, a lot of the, you know, you have something in your code that you check for a condition and then all of a sudden something in the hardware changes.
Yep.
And all of a sudden your code doesn't work anymore.
Yep. That's right.
It's another hardware problem. Okay. You know, I think I'd like to jump all the way almost to the end, Dave, here, because I think this is timely and it's the same way here. And Andreas.
Yeah, go.
Okay, you think this kind of fits in? Well, I think it does. So
we're going to do
it. I'm just going to forge ahead here. So, Andreas writes in, I have an issue here and I really need your help. In the attempt to not get caught, very wise, I set up a firmware password on my 13-inch MacBook Pro early 2011 running 10.8.3 and 16 gigs of RAM. Cool. Then I went to try it out by holding down the option key. Okay, and for those of you that don't know, the option key activates something on the Mac. Yes, but when you boot your machine, what it's actually activating is something called the startup manager. And what it's going to do is show all of you the bootable drives, whether they be internal or external. Now, you may have to wait a bit for external drives to show up, but eventually all the drives that are bootable will show up on your screen. And then you can pick one of them. For most recent machines, what you're going to see is your hard drive and something called recovery. Right? So here's the bad news. Not the bad news, but if you have firmware password protection enabled, you will be asked for that password first. And that's a security measure, because allowing people to boot directly into one of your partitions may not be what you want. Unfortunately, here's what happened. And I think I know what happened, but so we tried to log in, didn't have any luck, and the password field just went blank, which is what happens if you type in the wrong password. So we called up Apple, since they do not have an Apple store, or at least an Apple retail store in Denmark, and they said I should bring it somewhere to have it reset. Then I got thinking, because my keyboard is Danish, so we thought it was a language problem. I don't think it's a language or mapping of characters problem. I mean, we typed in at one point should be the same. So I don't think it was an issue, though he did note that there are some characters that are different on the Danish and English keyboard. So I think he made the attempt to take what he thought was the password and switch in those characters. Still didn't work. Now, all right, so he also looked up on Apple support communities saying, and this is the bad news kind of, Dave. So some articles on Apple support communities say that you can reset the firmware password in portables, I guess, or pretty much any Mac, I guess, by removing the RAM and doing a PRAM reset.
Yep. I remember that in the past. Yeah.
And then I saw something saying that it wouldn't work with later Macs. And yes, I found that as well. So, you know, as far as I see here, Dave, so what I found, and actually Apple echoes this here, and let me get the link here. So actually things have changed, since you could do the remove the RAM and reset PRAM trick, which was kind of a trick. I think it was an oversight actually in how they implemented this. So I guess Apple heard about this and they fixed it. Which I think is a good thing, unless you can't get back in. But basically here I found an article, and the title is, and it gives a number of machines here, one of them being the MacBook Pro early 2011, which he stated he has. And basically they say the resolution to recovering a lost firmware password is the title of the article. And basically what they say is, if this happens, you have to go to an Apple retail store. Okay, that's bad since he doesn't have one, but also an Apple authorized service provider can unlock this. And I actually did a bit of digging, and apparently what's involved in this process is you actually start up the machine, and then I think you have to do a quadruple handstand. No, what you have to do is, and I saw a YouTube video of this. If you hold down, I think it's Control Option Command Shift S, you get this big long hex code, and that's something that's unique to that machine. What happens is then the Apple authorized service provider sends that to Apple server somewhere, and then they get back a file that they then toss on the hard drive, and that effectively resets it.
Wow.
So it's having to do with, I think, encryption that involves the...
You want to talk about multi-factor authentication. Holy cow.
So what they're doing, and I think they're using, I read also they're using like an Atmel chip or something. So they're using a chip that's meant to be secure and that you can't reset like you could in the past year, but it's tied to whether it be a MAC address or a serial number or something. It's definitely tied to something that's unique in that machine. And that if you get this file back, if you try to put it on a machine that doesn't match it, it won't work. Now I did send him. So the first thing here, so I'll toss this in the room here. So here's that article saying you're out of luck. The second thing though, is that there is a finder here. Or a dealer finder, I guess, or Apple authorized service provider thing. So if you go to locate.apple.com and then you go a little further, it'll let you find people in a particular country. And I got to imagine, I mean, Denmark isn't like in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they got to have at least one.
Oh, yeah.
authorized Apple server. So not a retail store yet. You know, I guess they're getting around to it. But they certainly got to have some authorized Apple service providers, which can have the magic tools that will accomplish this. You know what I think could have happened, David? I've actually had this happen once, and thank goodness for things like, so I use LastPass, which is very one password like. I actually had an occasion where I actually did log into a site and thought I had typed in one password, and LastPass had captured it and it said, oh yeah, I saw you logged in somewhere. You want to save that? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then when I tried to log in at a later date and I thought I had memorized the password, as it turns out, I had transcribed two of the characters for some reason of what I thought I typed in. And I only realized this after I had LastPass. I'm like, what is wrong? I'm almost positive I typed whatever.
Yeah.
And when I went to LastPass and said, show me what I typed in, I'm like, oh, that's not what I thought I typed in.
Right.
Huh. Very cool.
So it could have been an inadvertent brain hiccup. And I don't know if transcribing to the characters, I mean, he included, you know, I think what is close to the password that was used. And it certainly looks. Yeah.
You know, I know you use LastPass and I use 1Password, so I like that because it allows us to talk about different features of the software without any assumptions being made. So one of the things I found on iOS now with the 1Password app, the current version, and I don't know what version that is. It doesn't want to tell me. I don't want to look. It's really what it comes down to. But anyway, and the previous version had this too, where it's got a web browser built into it and it seems a little crazy, but more and more I find myself using it because if I go to a website, I have two ways of logging into a website on my iPhone if I don't know the password in memory, right? Number one is I visit the website on Safari because that's, you know, the default browser and that's where it always brings me. And then I realize I'm on a tangent, but that's okay. And then I have to jump over to the 1Password app, look up my password, you know, maybe copy it to the clipboard, type my username, paste the password in if it lets me, and then log in. And now I'm logged in Safari, and maybe Safari will ask to memorize the password at that point. Maybe it won't. I don't know. So that's one way. The other way is to just copy the URL and then go to 1Password and go to the browser in 1Password, paste the URL in, and then it visits the page. And because I'm now in 1Password, I have a little button at the bottom that lets me log in and use the logins. I don't have to remember or pay or, you know, copy anything. And then it works. And so I'm finding myself using 1Password far more as the browser when I need to do things that require me to log in. And then I know that some of you are banging on your steering wheels if you're driving at this point saying, Dave, there's a better way. And you're right. You don't even have to copy the URL from Safari. You can just go up to the URL bar and type OP at the very beginning of the URL bar. So it says instead of http://, or https://, now it says OP http. And of course, OP is for 1Password. And you put that at the beginning and it automatically jumps over to the 1Password app. So you don't even need to copy the URL. So what I'm getting at here, John, is I wind up using the browser in 1Password a ton when I need to interact with sites that I need to log into. And so my question for you is, can you approximate that functionality in LastPass on your iOS device?
I believe you can, but I don't think I'm set up to do that.
Okay.
I do have a LastPass iOS app. Will let me log into my account and view all of the sites that are registered, including, so if I'm on the road and I don't happen to be near a computer with the LastPass plugin installed, I can take my iPhone and run the app and see what the password is there. Username and password is there. But yeah, I don't know. I think they have an advanced package, which I don't think I have installed, that will do the auto login stuff as well.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, it certainly does it on Safari or Firefox, not Chrome. I don't think they have a Chrome plugin.
On your Mac.
You correct. Mean. I do not presently have similar functionality set up on my iOS device.
Got it. Yeah, it's really handy. And, you know, it's funny. I don't impose technology on my wife, Lisa, all that often, you know, because and this actually goes back to my consulting days. I had some nerds that worked for me. I call them nerds because the name of the company was Computer Nerds. And so we had nerds that worked for us, and I'd get complaints from customers all the time saying, oh, you know, so-and-so came out and he or she installed all this stuff because they said I would like it, but really they liked it, but it's not for me, you know, and now my computer's all crazy. So, so I never did that. You know, it's just not a habit of mine. I set my computer up my way, but other people, I just kind of try and facilitate what they want to do. And, but the other day I noticed Lisa was like fighting with stuff. And I said, wait a minute. you know, you have one password on the computer. She's like, yeah, I mainly only use that for work stuff. I'm like, yeah, but you're out and about with your iPad mini now a ton. I said, there is a better way. And so I set it up for her and showed it to her. And she's like, this is going to change my world. I'm like, yeah, I know. She's like, oh, this is great. And now she uses it all the time. So, and it's cool because one password will sync either with iCloud amongst your iOS devices or Dropbox amongst everything. So I don't think the Mac version will do iCloud syncing yet, but it'll certainly do Dropbox, and the data is not all that big. So you can get a free Dropbox account and do it that way. So, oh, where the heck are we going now?
Well,
yeah,
Anthony.
Yeah. Yeah. This is good. This is sort of a not cool stuff found. I think, I mean, it's, you know, anyway, Anthony writes, can you have a look at the Mac app iCloud Drive from Zibity.com? I don't think this is a safe way to use your data on iCloud, as it is messing with iCloud files. So essentially, I'll finish what he's saying. It's messing with your iCloud files on your Mac and basically backdooring the process, making iCloud like iDisk or Dropbox, but certainly not the way Apple intended any of this to work. I like the idea, but I'm scared of the repercussions. So yeah, what iCloud Drive does is, you know, we've talked about this before. You have this mobile documents folder buried in your library folder on your Mac, and that folder is synced amongst all of the devices and Macs that are logged into that iCloud account. And this, I believe, if Anthony's description is right, is it's just using that folder to make this syncing happen, but it's giving you better access to it and sort of letting you use your iCloud like a Dropbox. And like we've said before, you can do this. And as of today, this works perfectly. However, this is 100% not documented or supported or even encouraged by Apple. So what it means is down the road, Apple may change the way iCloud manages that folder and might say, delete anything that's not part of anything from that folder that's not part of an app that has registered itself as part of this process. And so, you know, be careful, I guess, is the way I would go about this. So, but it is cool, you know, being able to use it like this and interact with it a little more easily than having to dig and all that good stuff. So, you know, maybe it's cool stuff found. Maybe it's a warning. I don't know. It's iCloud Drive.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. What do you think of it, John?
I'm sure after
they hear this discussion, which they will, I'll alert them to it. They may have some additional thoughts and might even be able to make us feel a little better about it. So, but on the surface, how do you feel?
I don't know about this undocumented stuff, you know?
Well, I guess my question is, you know, as I was explaining it here, here's the thing. It's possible this is using an entirely documented solution, right? Because think about this, right? I can have Pages run, and Pages can store files in iCloud. Now, what that means, and you and I know this in the background, is it's just saving these files in a place in this mobile documents folder, and then it gets synced to my other Mac, and then Pages can read it. And so we're used to thinking of iCloud, the prescribed usage, being for apps to share documents with the same app on another Mac. But this iCloud Drive is just an app, right? So it's just giving you more transparent access to the files that it is syncing on its own behalf, right? So if iCloud Drive has registered itself with iCloud and said, yep, I want to just store some files, iCloud doesn't care how it gets those files, right? I mean, in Pages, it gets them because you've created them and saved them there. But who cares if you copy them in, right? What's the difference? So maybe that's how it works. And maybe it's totally fine, right? If it's doing it all through, you know, the way it's supposed to do it, great. If it's sort of doing it through a backdoor, which is what Anthony presumed, and I presumed actually initially, then that's where it starts to get a little sketchy. So who knows? Maybe it's totally on the up and up. and it's just using file store or whatever. There was that big article that Rich Siegel kind of wrote for Ars Technica this week, or, you know, ish, about his frustrations with iCloud syncing. But there's essentially three ways to do it. And one is through core storage, but that's what he's having a problem with. But the file storing thing is pretty straightforward. So maybe that's all it's doing. So if that, in that case, then it's probably pretty cool. I don't know. Yeah. You want to take one, John?
Felix.
Go.
This took a little head scratching.
We like head scratching.
But I'm happy with the answer I came up with here. So Felix says, "Hi guys, I sometimes get the error message saying that the volume was not ejected properly. However, I often don't know which drive actually was ejected. How can I find out which drive was ejected?" So, two ways to do this. The easy way and the hard way. Or the cheapskate way and the give somebody some money way. So the way to do it with the tools at your disposal, if you are not afraid of the terminal, and don't be afraid of the terminal. You got to do some work ahead of time here. And that's the only caveat with this this technique here. But one thing that you can do, I'm thinking if I should work this backwards. No, I'm going to work forwards. So you need to get some information first. Disk util list is the command that you want to issue in the terminal. And as you may suspect, well, this is disutility. It's just a command line version. So you can, it's information that's available in disutility, but it may be arranged in a nicer way for you, or you can just do it quicker. So you type this out, and then what you're going to see is a list. On the left, you will see the Unix devices that all of your volumes are connected to. And in my case, I had two, dev disk 0 and dev disk 1. Dev disk 0 being the drive in my MacBook, and disk 1 being another disk, in this case, a USB disk. And then to the right, this is the important part. What you're going to see in the far right column of this list is something called an identifier. And this also harks back to the Unix device descriptor. So you're going to see what you see on the left column, disk 0, but then you're going to see the partitions on the drive. And they're going to be of the format like disk 0 S1, disk 0 S2, disk 0 S3, and so on. S, I believe, being a slice. In case you were wondering what the S stood for, I think that's what it stands for, or it sounds as good as anything. And then what's going to happen, if you then, and I did this at great peril and risk, I then took my USB flash drive, which is a Lexar 128 gigabyte, which I love to death, and pulled it out without ejecting it. And then I looked in the kernel to see if there was anything upsetting the kernel. And yes, there was. There was a message from kernel saying disk 1 S1 media is not present. And I think that's basically the same thing as the eject message. It's like, hey, what happened? So, and it said disk 1 S1. Well, what is disk 1 S1? Well, if I look in the list that I just generated, hey, it's the name of it is Lexar, type Windows FAT32. So that's how you can work your way backwards, assuming that you have a list, or you know, because I think typically all your partitions are going to get, if you plug them into the same port, are going to get the same disk 1, S1, or whatever. I don't know what I'd get.
I don't think it's ports. I think it's order.
Okay, it could be. So if I plugged in my other USB port, it probably still would be disk 1. But if I plugged in another disk ahead of time, then that would be disk 1. So it changes based on, I think I'm with you on that. So yeah, it changes based on the order and device in which devices were inserted. At least that seems to make sense.
Yeah.
The other way to do this is to get a tool that I like, and it's only a few bucks, I think, right now. And that's called Hardware Growler. Because Hardware Growler, if you pull a drive, it'll show you in a little growl window both of these events occurring, both that a USB device disconnected, and then at a higher level, it'll give you the name of it. And in my case, it said, because the name of the drive is Lexar, it said, yeah, Lexar went away. So I think Hardware Growler is an excellent tool, especially if you are having issues with the, because to me, this sounds like something to be concerned about, in that normally you shouldn't be getting these ejected properly messages unless you have people, you know, approaching your machine and just yanking USB peripherals at random, which I hope you don't. That's another problem. So either go to the terminal or Hardware Growler are the two ways you can determine. But again, Dave, this
I have a third way, you know, and you don't have to go to the terminal, and you don't have to install any third party software.
No way.
No way. You Hit run me. Disk Utility, the GUI version, or the GUI wrapper to it, I should say. And it's a little more manual a process, but or a little more pedantic a process. But what you do is you go and highlight your disks, and in Disk Utility itself, right there, it shows you the mount point, but doesn't show you the disk anymore. It used to show you the disk and slice, but now you can hit the little info button or go to the file menu and choose get info. And that will show you the disk identifier of that particular disk. So you can jump from disk to disk and find out which of these that is. So there you go. Yet another way to get this stuff.
And it looks like in our chat room, we have a number of people who, before they knew I'd say Hardware Growler, said, hey, how about Hardware Growler?
That's right. Well, you've turned everybody onto it. It's, I probably should
latest
use
release.
It.
Well, the latest release also includes a higher level of granularity. So you can break out Bluetooth devices, USB devices, network devices. The other thing I find it very handy for is to find out when software is doing like a secret background update, which for the most part only seems to be Google stuff like Chrome and all that.
Yeah.
And that you'll see these disk images, or you'll see disks being mounted with an alert from Growl, Hardware Growler, and you're like, I don't remember asking for this. It's a bit disconcerting that you all of a sudden in the background see a volume getting mounted. If I didn't know it was how Google does their software update, that would really kind of concern me greatly.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense.
But now having it makes sense when I see this happen. It's either Chrome. I think sometimes they'll update the AV components for their telephony and some other things, but okay.
No, it's good. All right. So it is World Backup Day. So, and I realize that this is just a construct. I think it was a group of Redditors, right? People on Reddit that started this, and it wasn't that long ago, maybe 4 years ago, something like that. But anyway, it's good to build awareness of backups. So we, regardless of the genesis of the holiday, we will celebrate it happily and emphatically here. So with that, John, let's both just go through our backup strategies and then I'm sure that will lead to a tangent or two, and we'll have a nice little, 7 to 10 minute detour here on our backups. And hopefully that helps to enlighten folks that haven't heard us talk about it, new listeners that haven't heard us talk about our backup strategy. And also, existing listeners, it doesn't hurt. In fact, I'm looking forward to this because I like to reevaluate things from time to time as well. So John, we'll let's start with you. Go ahead.
What my backup strategy is?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll have to talk about the devices that I have first. So it's the Mac Mini.
Yep.
MacBook Pro. And I would say the third primary one would be the iPhone.
Right. Okay.
I'm pretty much on both of the Macs, I have Time Machine running, and they're both targeting the Drobo with a special Time Machine partition.
Okay.
So that's stage one. The only thing in that case is I will exclude rather large items that I don't feel need to be backed up. And I guess the main one is, I'll play some Steam games. And the thing is, whenever they change or update, I mean, the updates can be huge, like on the order of gigabytes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I don't really need to update that, do I? Because they store all your account stuff in the cloud. So, and some other things like virtual disks with virtual machines, those tend to get backed up in one fell swoop.
No, they don't actually.
I've seen it happen. I think the type of image that I chose when I've done virtual box work. But no, you're right. No, it's good to discuss. Is that depending on the type of disk image that you choose, it may not separate itself into bands or stripes or whatever. That's in which case,
yeah, no, you're right.
Anytime you change it. But you're right, is that I think the default that things like Parallels and VMware set it up for, they have it in stripes so that it only backs up what has changed down to a certain level.
Right.
But it's better granularity than backing up an entire 20 gigabyte
right.
virtual disk image.
Yeah, right.
Which is what I feed.
Yeah.
So basically I do that, and then I will use the cloud services that I have right now. I would say the ones that I primarily use are Dropbox and SugarSync, and I will back up typically So one, you got to think about, how do you organize your data? And I would say any data that is important, I will store in the documents folder, which is really where you should. Well, I find it makes life easier. So what I do is I have important documents of various sorts on both machines, and I will use either Dropbox, or I actually like leaning to a SugarSync, because actually, no, Dropbox, I'd say, is probably not the best solution for this. Dropbox, I think, is still, I use it primarily to do sharing with other people, not so much for backups these days. Where SugarSync, I think, tends to lend itself to backing up specific folders on different machines. It's not kind of this group thing
right.
that Dropbox embraces. So, and I would say that's really... Oh, the third one. All right. So the third backup solution I have. So I told you about this Lexar drive that I love to death, and it's 128 gigabytes. So that's pretty substantial space. And I think it's only like $100. Well, it comes with backup software that runs not only on Mac and different Macs, but Windows. And what happens is, so the first time you get it, you install this backup software, which I think is done by a third party. And then basically you set up a backup profile and say, okay, anytime this drive is stuck in here, they'll have this thing called the, I think, Lexar Backup Manager. And it says, hey, I see you. I know who you are. Oh, you told me to back up your documents folder every time I see you. Okay.
Cool.
And it just starts backing up to it. And the write speed on it is pretty good. So you probably don't want to back up everything, but for critical documents. So what I'm embracing here with this backup strategy is, so one is to just do a backup. That's pretty, should be pretty clear. But number two, you should really try to have more than one backup of anything that's important to you. What we call, we like to call, single point of failure. And if you only have it in one place and that melts down or explodes, you're out of luck. So if something's important to you, like I'm doing, so I'll put it on both a thumb drive, and it backs it up onto the Drobo with the Time Machine, and it's on the thumb drive. So I got three backups of my important documents. And I think that's probably enough.
All right. There is one that you missed that I know you'll say, oh, I use that too. And that's Crash Plan, because I know you always turn Crash Plan off right before we start recording Mac Geek Gab.
Not anymore.
Oh, all right. Fair enough. Okay.
Well, they threw me a freebie and it just yelled at me for expiring. And I think it may be redundant, Dave, in that I think I've already got, I mean, it's certainly a nice product.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I really like it. But yeah, they sent me a thing basically saying, yeah, your free is up. And
yours expired last night, just like mine did, actually.
I
wasn't smart enough to re-up my Crash Plan. You know, they're a sponsor, obviously, of the show in general, not this episode particularly. But, you know, they had that great deal and everything. And I was foolish and didn't re-up mine. But so I have it on one machine now, Crash Plan. And actually, the machine that I have Crash Plan running on is my disk station, where I store all our movies and everything like that. So I probably need to enhance that into a family plan. But it just happened like 7 hours ago that my Crash Plan expired. So,
another one.
11 hours ago. Oh, okay. This, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I just saw in the chat room someone mentioned something which I didn't think of off the top of my head, but. And I don't use it frequently, but when I do, this is always the tool that I use, and that is a Carbon Copy Cloner.
Okay.
So whenever I'm doing a system upgrade, like a major system upgrade, like operating system or something like that, I will do a full backup of the entire drive with Carbon Copy Cloner, because I want a bootable one.
Yes.
Because if the upgrade fails for some reason, then that means I have one less bootable device.
Right.
And thank goodness that you can, you know, and this has always been the thing with the Mac that has really amazed me, is that the flexibility within which you can boot an external drive that has the operating system on it is pretty seamless. And I certainly, even now with Windows 7, I still haven't found that to be the case with Windows, is that you can't just plug in a USB drive and boot from it if it has a bootable image.
Not an image. That's right. It has to have a bootable partition. That's right.
Well, even then, I think the support for booting from an external device is still not as...
Oh, it works.
Not what... Okay.
Any Intel machine can boot from USB. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I haven't tried it lately. I'll have to investigate how to get that happening with my Windows 7 installation.
Oh, yeah. Windows... Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Now, see, what I'm saying is that whereas a Mac OS X volume tends to have all the kernel extensions and all the stuff that you need to boot properly right. on pretty much any Mac, maybe sometimes missing a few features if you don't have all the same kernel extensions, but I found that it does a much better job than something that's kind of specific to a Windows machine. Yep. I'll have to revisit it.
Yeah, no, you're right. With Windows, it might not. I'm with you on that. All right. So, I'll go in a slightly different order just because that's how my brain works. I start with the clone. Super Duper runs every night at 6:30 PM, clones my main hard drive, which is my SSD in the iMac at the office, clones that to a partition on the, my iMac has the SSD and the 1 terabyte drive. This is pre-Fusion drive days, so they are not bonded together. They're two separate disks and treated that way. So it clones my SSD to a partition on the 1 terabyte disk, which is really, really handy. It gives me that immediately bootable clone if I ever need it, and I'm good to go. And so I have that for that backup. Then I have Time Machine running on all the machines. And Time Machine either backs up, you know, the office and the house are separate. So the machines that are in the office and the studio, which is one building, back up to the time capsule, which lives over at the house. And all the machines at the house use Time Machine to back up to the Drobo FS, which lives over here in the office. So that way, it's not a really an offsite backup, but it would take quite a bit for both of these buildings to burn simultaneously. It would be, I would have much bigger problems if that were to happen. So anyway, that's sort of round one. And then like you, John, I use a variety of different, you know, what I'll call cloud-based services. Dropbox, like you, I started with it and used it for everything because it was the first. But now it pretty much is relegated to only sharing with people that don't have any other service other than Dropbox. And slowly but surely, all of those people are moving to different things. And some of those things are things like SugarSync is a decent cloud-based service. And for a long time, when I moved from Dropbox to SugarSync, I stored all my documents there so I could have all my docs on all my Macs. And then about a year ago, when I got my Synology Disk Station, I moved everything into a product they have called Cloud Station, which is their own version of personal cloud. And so all of my machines, including my iOS devices and everything, sync documents to Cloud Station, which stores my stuff on the disk station. It took a little bit to set it up and all of that stuff, but I'm a geek and I like this stuff. So I've been managing my own cloud for a while here, and I really like that because I like the fact that my documents aren't being stored with like Dropbox or SugarSync where anybody I call those services secure until a subpoena. Now it's not that I expect a subpoena to be coming, but you know, if someone forces their hand, they can get at my data at Dropbox and SugarSync because it's all encrypted with their key, not my key, my password, their key. So I use the personal cloud thing here. And then, as I mentioned, I use CrashPlan. Now, up until last night, I had CrashPlan running on a couple of my machines because I had a family account that, like you, John, they had given us about a year ago. And then on Friday, I got the notification that, oh yeah, it's going to expire. And I thought, oh, okay. And so I signed up for a 1 year account for just the one machine, which is the disk station that has all of our movies. I don't back up all of our movies to CrashPlan because it would take forever, but I back up some of the more important ones, and everything that's in my personal cloud and all of that stuff gets backed up to CrashPlan using my encryption key. So secure past a subpoena, And it's fully encrypted with my stuff. And so that goes up to the cloud. And then lately Pete and I have been messing with the concept of seeding Drobos with CrashPlan data that we then swap. And so my stuff will back up to Pete's house and Pete's stuff will back up here. I've been having a problem because I had this image that I could take my old, you know, FireWire and USB based Drobo, hang it USB off of my disk station and back up directly to it. And that has been fraught with error. The Linux HFS Plus drivers that are baked into the disk station aren't quite ready for a disk of this size. And so it's been causing a lot of grief. So now I've got that Drobo hanging off of my iMac in the office, but I just don't like that because it's not as pretty and efficient to do it that way, but it is working. So I'm seeding that drive. And that has everything on the disk station, including all of the movies and everything from all of my Macs is syncing. CrashPlan, you know, you can, their pay service is the storage in the cloud. You can back up to your other computers, be they local on the network or elsewhere. for essentially for free. And so that's sort of what I'm doing here is I have them all backing up to this one drive, and then I'm going to give that drive to Pete, and then they will just magically start backing up to the drive when it lives at Pete's house and he attaches it to CrashPlan. And lastly, only because it's newly, is the transporter, which had I had that a year ago, sure. I would have immediately adopted that as my personal cloud solution because it's just so easy to use. But like I said, I kind of already had the disk station in place, so that's why I'm using that for my personal cloud. But as far as ease of use and even price, I mean, the disk station is massively expensive to just do personal cloud with, whereas the transporter is, you know, cheap and easy. So, and I'm using some of that. And in fact, you know, I've been working on some stuff with Dave Wiska's songs that we've been recording. He writes the songs and I put drum tracks on them. And we used Dropbox for the first project. And just last night he asked me, he's like, wait a minute, do you have a transporter? I'm like, of course. And he's like, forget Dropbox. We're moving to transporter. I'm like, yep, absolutely. More space, easier to manage. And we're not dealing with, you know, wacky syncing Dropbox problems. So, you know, slowly but surely we're kind of moving away from that too. So, I think that's my backup strategy.
That's cool. And I think It may lead into here, Dave.
I did want to say one thing, two things actually. Number one is when you mentioned you were excluding large things like your disk images and all that stuff. I do that, but I also exclude things, you know, I'm backing up a lot of computers. And four of them are computers that I log into regularly. The one in the studio, the one in the office, the iMac in the house, and my MacBook Air. These computers are also used by other people at times, but they all have my accounts on them. They all have my mail. They all have my Dropbox. They all have my SugarSync. And I think you see where I'm going here. From my main iMac in the office, I let it back up everything. But here in the studio, I exclude my mail folder, my Dropbox folder, my SugarSync folder from being backed up to the Time Machine because I would simply be storing, you know, four copies of that same data in my, you know, on my Time Machine backups. And I certainly don't need to do that. So I exclude that stuff too. And to exclude mail, that's sort of the one that's a little wacky. You would exclude your home/library/mail folder. So that's how I do that. And one last thing, John, if I may I?
You may.
Okay. Dolly Drive. We would be remiss in having a backup discussion without mentioning Dolly Drive. And the reason is, you know, these guys have created a one-stop shop for pretty much, you know, doing everything that you'd want to do. They started out as just Time Machine in the cloud. They've actually walked away from that. They do not use Time Machine anymore because Time Machine was never built to be used in the cloud. It was really never built to be used with HFS Plus, but you know, whatever. We won't go into that. So they now have their own engine, which is way more reliable than you know, hanging it off of Time Machine. But they also do, their software will create a local clone. Their software will let you do cloud sharing and storage like we're talking about here. They've got a whole range of things, and you really could do multi-tiered backups with just Dolly Drive, because it's, you know, it's just software managing. It's kind of all in one, if you will. So I throw that out there too. That's all I got. You said you were going to say something, John. Sorry.
Suggestion for a direction to take here. So one, I'm just looking at my, my mini here, and yeah, Steam takes up about 30 gigs. With all the various games. So yeah, I don't need to back that up because I can just download it again. All right. Now, I was thinking the direction, I don't know if we want to touch on Paul here because it kind of relates to backups, and I don't know if I have any answer.
Which one's this? I got to pause.
Paul?
Yeah, the drives one?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and bring it up. Yeah, because it's a good follow-up and we can wrap up that discussion from a couple of weeks ago. Sure. And we'll do Paul and then we'll do John. Because that's definitely related, the one toward the bottom. And then I think we're done. So go ahead. Yeah. Take Paul.
Yeah. Or at least I'll try to address it here. So, hey guys, from Paul, I know you mentioned Seagate Green Drive's failing in one of your NAS devices that houses all the show's archive data. I'm a network manager that recently had a nightmare experience with Western Digital Caviar grain drives that are eco-friendly and supposed to keep power consumption costs down. Let's see. I want to try to summarize this. So basically, someone else had built the RAID arrays and thought it'd be a good idea to use the green drives.
Just, like,
green
we, drives just being, like you and I did. In
yeah,
our
well, green drives and, being yeah. drives that I guess are specially made to consume less power.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me sounds like a great thing if you can, you know, do it properly.
And that's why I put them in my NAS drives, because I really, with my NAS, I don't care as much about the speed. So if the drives are a little bit crippled speed wise, but use less power, fine. It's archival storage. Slow data. So go ahead, John. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And he says, what a mess. As soon as I began to support the servers, I found out that the drives in the onboard RAID were spewing alerts saying there was RAID degradation. The green drives were failing left and right. When in reality, there was nothing wrong. A drive would show us offline and you would have to pull the drive, test it, find it operational, introduce it back into the RAID set and pray it worked. It never did. I eventually started to swap out those green drives for WD black drives. I don't know, so the caviar or just the regular drives and PCI RAID connectors bypassing the onboard RAID. So I guess the summary here is that at least in Paul's case, he had a problem that it sounds like he attributed. And I guess he got correlation that, yes, in fact, it was. Well, I don't know. It sounds like he said he was changing the RAID approach as well.
So well, he's changing the RAID approach because he can't rely on these green drives, I think is
all right,
sort of
working with the initial RAID solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So yeah. So covers two things here. So to me, it's, I mean, I'm kind of scratching my head here. I mean, I certainly believe what you and what both of you said, as far as these green drives, getting temperamental in certain RAID enclosures, but you know, I'm struggling with how power management, and maybe it's just because the drives don't respond as quickly. And the RAID array, whether it be hardware or software, has a certain expectation that, yeah, this drive should be available. Otherwise, I'm going to classify you as failing. And maybe that's what's happening.
I think that's exactly what's happening. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the most obvious thing with a green drive is that it goes in a low power state where it probably spins down the motor and all of that. And yeah, so, you know, if anything, I would think, wouldn't it be nice if the RAID had something? Either the RAID was smart enough.
Hmm.
To talk to the drive, and the drive maybe has, and I'm sure the drive has a pin, or you could ask it. And I'm just thinking that if there was an exchange, like the array says, "Hey, drive, you ready?" And it's like, "Nope, but, you know, I'm working on it. You know, yeah. It's going to take me a while. I'm one of these green drives. Can you please wait just a little longer for me to spin up before you claim that I'm dead?"
Right.
So it almost to me sounds like it's an unintended. I don't know if the green drives aren't to some spec or the RAID array is a bit too hasty in.
But of course, I've seen this with multiple branded RAID arrays, right? It happened with Drobo and it happened with. Now, I'm not saying you're wrong. You're probably very right. But it's happening with the Disk Station as well as the Drobo. Now, thankfully for me, the Disk Station would let this happen and keep using the drive. The Drobo, once it happened like two or three times, it was like, nope, I'm not talking to that drive anymore. So thankfully I didn't lose any data.
Now I wonder if it's the implementation, because Dave, so what I got, so I wrote back to Paul and, you know, thanked him. And obviously we just discussed this, but, once I got the FS from the Drobo folks, thank you very much. I ordered three per your recommendation of what they call, the Western Digital Caviar Green 2 terabyte SATA 3 IntelliPower 64 megabyte cache, bulk OEM, blah, blah, blah. And then at a later point, I put in both a 2 and a 1 terabyte Hitachi drive that I had sitting around. One was one that had previously been in my I think G5.
My issue is because I did the same thing. And the issue is that they seem to do totally fine until you start moving massive amounts of data or consistently moving data for say a period of 10 hours, right? When I started doing this crash plan seeding, that's when all these problems reared their ugly heads with these green drives. First on the Drobo that I was writing to, and then on the Disk Station that I was reading from. And that's when things got really ugly. So it was like, wait a minute, you know, I can rely on these drives and they'll sit there and act like everything's fine. And the RAID array won't moan about them right up until the point that I need to actually get lots of data off or onto them. And that's when they start to crater. So that's kind of what made me, I don't know. Now I warrantied them through Seagate and they sent them to me, and I've actually just finished this morning was when the third one in the disk station, which was the last one, finally got itself up to speed, and I'll, ship the old ones back to Seagate. But it's almost like I know this is going to happen again. But I also know I didn't lose data. It was just inconvenient. But the next time this happens, it's funny because I bought the green drives because they were recommended to me on Drobo's website. Now, Drobo has a which drive do you choose the right drives for your Drobo thing, which we'll put in the show notes. But and I put it in the chat room right now for those of you at MacGeekab.com/stream. But it still says that green drives are good for sort of the low end Drobos, but for none else. They don't recommend them. But what they do recommend are red drives. Now, this is a Western Digital only concept. Red. Yeah. Yeah. They're called Western Digital Red. Yep.
That's kind of funny. Like they're almost like thumbing their nose.
Yeah.
The green, like, oh yeah, we're going to be the opposite of green. We're going to be red.
Right. Now, so WD still sells their green drives like you have, but they also sell these red drives, which were totally built to be used in 24/7 operating environments, built to be in RAID arrays, probably as a reaction to all the issues that people have been having with these green drives. So, you don't have to use the red drives. You can just get pro level drives from anyone. But WD, it's marketing and it's smart marketing, I think. So red drives, there you go. All right. Let's see. How much time do we have? We have enough to do this because this is the right show to do it. So we were talking about, and we have talked about personal cloud, the transporter concept, which is hardware, sort of dedicated hardware for personal cloud only. You can use it for other things, but, by and large, that's what it's built for. And then something like the Synology, the disk station that has personal cloud as a feature of the overall RAID in their cloud station product or cloud station package, I should say. And that works. But both of these are separate hardware. And John writes, I was a little disappointed that I listened to your discussions about this, and I was a little disappointed that you didn't cover any non-appliance personal cloud replacements. I've been looking at OwnCloud, but I don't see a Mac install for it. And I was wondering if you knew of any personal cloud solutions for OS X server that have mobile apps and web access in addition to desktop clients. And in fact, yes, John, OwnCloud is the right thing to use. You just didn't search far enough, and I've sent John the link, but there is a Mac OS distribution of OwnCloud. What OwnCloud is an open source personal cloud solution. It's got file serving, it's got calendar serving, I think it's even got contact sharing, but it is open source. There are iOS apps available, and they're very robust. The way I learned about this was there was actually an OwnCloud package available for my disk station when Cloud Station was kind of early on. So I messed with it a little bit and then just went with Cloud Station because it worked fine for me. And I figured it would have better, more regular support from Synology. Though OwnCloud, like any open source thing that lots of people use, it probably is being updated more frequently than Cloud Station is. And their iOS app works great. And you can install it. You don't even need OS X server. You just need OS X. So you could install this on your Mac, and it's accessible not only from your local network, but from the outside world. And of course, the server is free. It's open source. The iOS apps, I think, you got to pay for, but it's cheap. It's less than $5 for the app. So it's not a big deal. And then you're using your own storage and all of that stuff. So OwnCloud is the trick. You would need, in order for OwnCloud to work, you need Apache running on your Mac, and you need PHP running on your Mac, which is a language for real-time applications to run on the web. And then you need MySQL because that's a database backend and it uses that for some things. Now, you can install each of these. Some of them are installed on your Mac automatically, and you can install each of these manually, because it's just Unix, and if you're comfortable doing that, that's great. But an easier solution is to install something called MAMP, M-A-M-P, which is MySQL, a Mac version of a Mac package of Apache, MySQL, and PHP, M-A-M-P. Excuse me. So I missed the cough button on that one. So so you install MAMP, and then you install OwnCloud. And in fact, there is a link that describes this whole process. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. So, and it goes very, very easily. So yes, you can do personal cloud on your Mac if you're willing to go through a little bit of that.
And I think there's another one that we haven't mentioned as of late, Dave, and actually I haven't really used recently, but I'm reviving it right now on my Mac Mini, and that is a service called the Pogo Plug.
Okay.
And I think that's close to what you're looking for here, because so I'm running the app right now. I'm logged in through Safari, and what it shows in the left-hand column of the web app here is JB Mac Mini and JB MacBook Pro, which are my two computers, and then Pogo Plug Cloud. And last I used it, unless they change something, one of the nice things it does if you install their app is allows you to share your machine as a, I would say, a personal cloud. So I think Pogo Plug is certainly worth a look.
Huh? Cool.
I don't know. Have you done, you ever dabble with...
No, you had done so. I thought there was something limiting about Pogo Plug in this regard, but maybe I'm... because I don't, I think you're storing your stuff in their cloud. I don't think you're, I mean, because it's a pay service, right? You got to pay $5 a month. And I think at some point your data is stored with them.
Yeah. I gotta read through.
I'm not convinced
because I'm not paying them anything and I can access my stuff remotely stored on my machine. So,
huh? Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I would be curious to, for some reason I thought there was a weird, it was that I guess what I understood it to be is a hybrid approach, but maybe I'm wrong. So that, yeah, research and let us know, cause this would be, you know, a good thing for this kind of ongoing conversation.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying here, yes, you can store your data in our cloud or on your own device. So it sounds like they're,
So there's Pogo Plug and then there's Pogo Plug PC and PC. It sounds like PC is what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. All right. Cool. More stuff. Fun. We love it. All right. What else do we have? I think what we have is that the show is coming to a close today because I think we're pushing our limits here, despite the fact that it's a holiday. So it's time to bring the band in, John.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that was fun. Let's see. Wrapping up the last day of March, the seventh Sunday. Sorry. Did I say the seventh? Why did I say that? The fifth Sunday of March. What do we have? What else do we have to say here, John?
I got one thing to say.
I have no idea what that's going to be. Go.
Feedback@MacGeekGab.com is the email address that you write to if you would like to submit questions, tips, praise, criticism, joke of the day, inspirational messages.
Cookies?
That's where you send it.
That's it.
You can send cookies. Yes.
That's right.
Or brownies, or
I like brownies.
Eggs.
I like brownies, but I you know, they make those pans that have like the windy pans so that you get all
you were
edges.
Talking about this.
Yeah. I actually don't like edges on brownies at all. I want a pan that has no edges. But thankfully, my wife loves the edges, so we are very compatible in this way. So it's good.
Oh, the edge pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like the crunchy. If I want crunchy, I eat a cookie.
It's impossible. You can't not have edges.
Dude, don't say it's impossible. We could somehow suspend this thing while it's being baked. Okay, so it doesn't have like the pan edge There's a way. I know there's a way. It's going to involve a lot of technology and it's going to cost a fortune, but there's a way. What else?
But you did hear the address that I mentioned, Dave, right?
Well, you said feedback at MacGeekGab.com, but I was like pie in the sky here. Well, brownie in the sky was sort of where I was. But yes, you did say feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
Correct.
You know, but John,
that's not the only. Yeah, go.
I was going to say you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4-3-3-5.
That's right. You can find the show notes that John and actually John and I and the people, the folks in the chat room lovingly handcraft. And then John goes back through them and adds some timestamps and makes them all polished and nice. At MacGeekGab.com is where those will exist per show. Or you can find those show notes right there in the app, actually, in the MacGeekGab app. Not only can you find the show notes, you can listen to the show, you get chapters, you can send feedback in, you can leave bookmarks, you can send audio feedback right there from within the app. It's actually, or you can, when the show is live, you can join the chat room and not only chat with others right inside the app, but stream the show as well. So, yavol. What else do we have here, John?
Facebook.com/MacGeekGab.
That we do.
You will see notifications when the various forms of the show are posted, when show notes are updated, and more often than not, when the next episode is going to start. If you'd like to tune in on the either chat with us or hear the live stream,
it's all good. It's all good. Did you mention Twitter yet, John?
I didn't, but if I did, Dave, I would tell you that you can reach or you can see what's happening with the show at MacGeekGab. You can see what I'm doing at John Efron, what you're doing at Dave Hamilton, what Pilot Pete is doing at Pilot Pete, and what's happening in the Mac Ecosphere at Mac Observer.
That's right.
The Twitters. Now, along with the Twitters, I got to admit, Dave, I haven't really. There's some things happening in this this other platform, competing platform called app.net. And I believe Mac Observer has posted. I don't know if it's a never ending feed of app.net codes. But
no, it's. I think we still have some. They gave us several hundred to give away. And I think we are not quite there yet. So. Now we might have hit it. Promo code's no longer valid, unfortunately. So, but if you want an app.net invite, follow us. I know this sounds weird. Follow MacGeekGab on Twitter, and occasionally we get like 5 a day that we can give out. We don't always give out 5 each day, but when I think about it, or when John thinks about it, we go and generate. Actually, I get them, so it's my account because I have a paid account at app.net. So I get them. I get 5 a day, but I'm happy to give them out to MacGeekGab listeners, of course. So follow us there, and when I think about it, I'll put out a call, and you reply to us, and then we DM you with your code, and you're good to go. So
it's about as active as my G+.
You're not following the right people. Seriously, it's actually very, very active over there. So.
Yeah, my only problem is I have to blend it into my current
correct
thing, which is basically right now I'm on Twitter and I mirror my stuff to Facebook, and that kind of works for me because I can get notifications via both. I haven't found, being a cheapskate, I haven't found the right app.net client that will also communicate with my other social media platforms, and that right now I just have app.net on my iPhone, and I'm typically not really running things on that too often. I've seen the number of people friending me now snowballing, which indicates to me that I think I'm hitting some critical mass, or just enough people are seeing that I bothered to check in that now they're like, oh, John's there, okay, let's yeah, I've noticed a lot of them. I'm getting a lot of the emails, which I think I'm going to have to shut off at some point.
We put your app.net ID in our post at TMO. So yes. When people were using that's, I think that's where a lot of those new ones this week anyway came from. So.
Yeah. Or I just went through the list of followers and I'm like, oh, I know who that is. Yeah. Okay. I'm being a bit more selective.
That's good.
Well, and they're just trying to add people that I actually know.
That's a good thing. All right. I think it's time. I think we can roll this one out here. Of course, before we do that, we'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast and also from GetAppler.net. He takes this show and converts it to AAC for us and you, adding all those chapters and all that good stuff. We'd also like to thank Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com for all the bandwidth that gets the show from us to you. And of course, the podcast marketplace with BB Edit from Barebone Software, Text Expander, and now PDF Pen Pro 6 from Smile. In addition to Gazelle out there for selling your stuff, Squarespace, and as mentioned in the show, Crash Plan and Transporter, Connected Data, all through Backbeat Media. John, if you had some advice to share on a day like this, especially a holiday like this, World Backup Day like this, what might that advice be?
Well, it might be don't get caught.
Made up.